Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We are going to be talking about a lot of different topics today, as we usually do. We're going to start with one that has not gotten as much attention of late as it warrants. Specifically, the war ongoing in Ukraine at the hands of Vladimir Putin and his invading force, and the prospects that worse than even the systematic destruction of Ukraine that is now underway might be in the offing, given Vladimir Putin's nuclear threats, his doctrine, his capabilities. To talk about all of this, I'm very pleased to have with us one of the foremost experts in the United States on Russia, before that, the Soviet Union, the leadership of Vladimir Putin, and the threats that all of that represents to the United States. His name is Dr. Stephen Blank. For many years, he was a very distinguished professor at the Army War College. He writes prolifically. I've lost track of the numbers of books and articles. The latter, I think, is over 1,000 at this point. All extremely thoughtful and drawing upon a level of expertise about what has gone on in the Kremlin over, well, centuries, but certainly decades, and what is underway there now under Vladimir Putin's regime. Dr. Blank, it's so good to have you back at Securing America. Thank you, sir, for your time.
Thank you for having me back, Frank.
I want to talk with you first about Ukraine, the war there, a sort of situation report, if you would, as to where things stand at the moment as you see them and where they may be going.
Well, right now, the Russian forces have taken what is called an operational pause. That doesn't mean there's no combat, but that there are basically artillery probes rather than sustained ground fighting. The Russians are trying to reorganize, rest, recuperate, and figure out where they make their next move. I also think that we are beginning to see signs of a Ukrainian counteroffensive. They are making advances in the south towards the city of Kherson, which is near the Black Sea, and the Sea of Azov. And they are also clearly gearing up to fight a major offensive to liberate the entire Black Sea coast, or as much of it as possible. So,
wow, that would include Crimea.
Zelensky ordered this about 2 or 3 days ago. So there may be what you might call, quote, a lull, although they're still fighting. But this is not going away anytime soon.
And let me ask you, Steve, when you say liberate the entire Black Sea coast, are you talking about Crimea as well, or just the main body of Ukraine?
I don't think they have the capability to do all of Crimea at this point. But they clearly want to get back what has been lost to the Russians within the boundaries of Ukraine after the seizure of Crimea. So that's that's at least the stated intention.
And do you think they have the capabilities actually to even liberate the rest of the Black Sea coast? That seems to be a pretty hard target at the moment, is it not?
There's certain conditions that have to be fulfilled. Namely that the West keep pumping weapons into Ukraine. What we need in Ukraine is what one Air Force general said to me years ago, a hot production line. And the weapons go directly to Ukraine. And whatever the Ukrainians say they need, as President Nixon said about Israel during the Yom Kippur War, double the order. That's what needs to happen. And then you may see successes that might now, the successes that will be forthcoming then.
Steve, let me just ask you, you're a serious student of our national security posture as well as that of the Russians. We have concerns, I think, about the capacity of the United States, talking about hot production lines, to continue to provide the kind of military wherewithal that the Ukrainians may seek without you know, leaving rather bare our own arsenal, especially against the possibility that we might find it needed in the face of a Chinese threat at the same time. How would you recommend allocating these limited resources, given the problem that you've described and the possibility of something else emerging, given especially the collusion between the Russians and the Chinese?
Well, as you mentioned, remember in my answer, I said the West. Mm. This is up to Europe as well. And, you know, we were the arsenal of democracy, to use FDR's phrase, in World War II. And I think we can do it again. What we need is the will to do it rather than to be encumbered in legal and bureaucratic red tape, which is, as you know, all too common in this town. And the president has to put his authority on the line here, both with the allies and at home, and get it done. This is in the vital, and I mean this, the vital interest of the United States and the vital interest of our NATO, and I would even argue Asian allies as well. So
make that case, if you would, Steve, because I don't think we've heard it often enough.
It's very simple. Russia has been at war with the West since 2005. Mr. Putin has said so. Countless scholars in my business and others have said so. Countless Russian officials have said so. Now it is kinetic. What we don't wish to spend in Ukraine will come back and force us to spend much, much more later on when the next round of war begins, because the Russian government will not be satisfied with only Ukraine.
What do you think it seeks beyond Ukraine at this point? And are we talking about the Russian government or Putin, or is it both?
Empire. Well, Russia seeks empire, not the Soviet empire. That's gone. But it seeks the Russian empire, which is a somewhat different phenomenon. Russia has always been an empire. That's what Putin wants. And that means an imminent threat to the sovereignty and integrity, well, not only of Belarus, which is already compromised, but all the Baltic states, Poland, Romania, NATO.
You know, and all of Ukraine, needless to say.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And Putin is prepared, do you think, at this point, to actually pursue all of those objectives, even if it means confronting NATO very directly?
They are pursuing these objectives in forms other than war: information, subversion, corruption, energy blackmail, now grain blackmail, all these other things. If they needed to, they would go to war. But I mean, what they would probably do is take Ukraine and refurbish the army as soon as, if they could. So the point is to stop them here at a cost which would be less than having to defend NATO. And the same would be true in Asia, because if people see that the Russians can get away with this stuff, they will make similar encroachments. Just this morning, North Korea recognized, quote, the independence of Donetsk and Luhansk provinces in Ukraine as a symbol of their solidarity with the Russians and, for that matter, the Chinese against the United States. And as we know, North Korea is continuing its nuclear and missile buildup. So the cost of defending Ukraine is much less than the cost of defending our alliances and vital interests in both Europe and Asia.
I think that's a very compelling argument myself. There are those on the right in this country who, of course, disagree, but I think your point is very well taken.
There are those on the left who disagree.
Well, on the left, too. I mean,
yeah, that's cool.
Their voices are not as vocal, I think, as those on the right at the moment.
Well, it depends where
that's
you
true.
Are.
That's true, how audible they are. Steve, we have to take a short break. We're going to come back just a moment. But I do want to ask you, when we come back, about a question that is now dogging many of us who think, as you do, that we need to be in this fight, at least to the point of arming the Ukrainians. And that is, do we have confidence as to what's happening to the weapons we're giving them? Are they being actually utilized, and to what effect? We'll talk about that and much more with Dr. Stephen Blank, a longtime professor, very considerable intellect on the Russian threat, right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The U.S. and Israeli governments declared for the umpteenth time today that Iran will not be allowed to acquire nuclear weapons. It ain't necessarily so. Israel's interim Prime Minister Yair Lapid is a leftist up for election. He's happy to have a paper pretext not to act in the only way that will, at this point, prevent the mullahs from getting the bomb at any time, namely a full-scale assault on their nuclear weapons program. President Biden is determined to prevent such an attack by Israel as his administration begs the Iranians to sign another bogus agreement forswearing taking that step. The president's promises to use all instruments of American power to prevent it may give unfounded hope to Israelis and others in the mullah's crosshairs, but its only practical effect will be to run out the clock on the preemption option. This is Frank Gaffney. We're back, and we are continuing our conversation with one of the country's foremost experts on Russia, on Vladimir Putin, his regime, his military capabilities, his order of battle, as they say, as well as his doctrine. And Steve, you've made the case that it's going to be a lot less costly for us to contend with Putin's ambitions and defeat them in Ukraine, specifically by giving the weapons required for the Ukrainians to do the fighting, than it is if Putin succeeds in Ukraine and then acts on his ambitions to take a lot more territory, to reconstitute a Russian empire, including by taking on member nations of the NATO alliance. One question that we keep hearing is, well, that's all well and good, Dr. Blank, but who knows what's happening to the weapons that we're sending the Ukrainians? Is there accountability for them? Do we have confidence that they're actually being brought to bear against the Russians and effectively? Or are they simply being, you know, sold off on secondary markets to others and more money out the door for American taxpayers, but not much to show for it?
First of all, the weapons are being used, and that's not being reported in the press. So I can put anybody's mind at ease. I mean, these weapons are being deployed and are being used with great effectiveness. Second, you probably will have cases down the road where weapons end up in black or secondary or tertiary markets. That's incidental to the main mission. I mean, that's a cost of doing business here. Corrupt. You know, I don't like to say this, but corruption is inevitable in human affairs. And it's much less worrisome to me than the threat of a Russian empire. And the cost we incur or the risk we run by this is minimal compared to the threat that we're facing.
This is a very significant threat indeed. And I wanted to turn to a piece of it that you've written about very powerfully recently at Real Clear Defense, namely the nuclear aspect of Vladimir Putin's power. Tucker Carlson, I think last night, pointed out that the economy of Russia is smaller than that of Italy, what obviously makes it a player in world affairs, and Putin has understood this very well, is its enormous investment in nuclear capabilities and its insistence that they can be used in nuclear war fighting as well. Talk a little bit about, first of all, the capabilities that are in place. And I'm thinking not just, if you would, sir, about the military nuclear deliverable weaponry, much of which has been very recently modernized, but also the efforts that the Russians have made to make more credible their idea that nuclear war can be fought and won, in terms of leadership protection and comprehensive missile and air defenses and civil defense as well.
Well, we could be here for hours, but basically Russian doctrine presupposes that nuclear weapons, particularly low yield or so-called tactical nuclear weapons, could be used to force the West to acquiesce in these limited conquests, followed by wars of subversion.
This is the so-called escalate to de-escalate.
It's not escalate to de-escalate. It's really a broader concept of permanent escalation control, where they control the whole process from start to finish in any crisis. And they believe that the threat of this will inhibit the Allies. And the threat of nuclear weapons has inhibited much of the Western response. We're not sending them planes, for example, which would be a great help to Ukraine. We're not breaking the blockade of the Black Sea, which is absolutely illegal by any stretch of the imagination, is now holding up the world to very likely famines in third countries, Africa.
That could be greatly alleviated were the grain from Ukraine to get out.
Well, if the blockade was broken, the grain would flow and that would be the end of it. The thinking is that we have nuclear weapons and the threat, which they do everything to make credible. They do nuclear exercises with their conventional exercises and so on. The threat is therefore that if you push us, if quote, if we are provoked, we may use these things. And they constantly reiterate this. They get up on the media and say we could turn London into a garbage dump in 2 minutes or something like that, or you know, the United States and so on. And this makes an impression. In the paper, I've quoted a number of high-ranking analysts and officials who've served in government who said they always took Russian nuclear threats as credible. Well, if you take the threats as credible, then they are credible. And
it's the idea of deterrence, right?
Nuclear threat. Well, that's the idea. But a credible nuclear threat is, of course, an extraordinarily serious affair. So as a result, this inhibits the Western response, and they constantly go back to this. They've been doing this since 1956.
But, Steve, would you just address this question of the degree to which nuclear threats are made very much more credible if you have taken the lengths that they've gone to, the lengths that they've gone to, taken the steps they've taken protect the things that they prize most, the leadership, of course, on the one hand, and key population.
Well, they have built an extraordinarily ramified conventional nuclear capability. And what's more, every conventional exercise is correlated with a nuclear exercise. The threats are therefore made credible by that. Also, in their initial deployments in Ukraine, in regard to the war of Ukraine, they moved their naval and nuclear naval capabilities out to stations which we would expect to see in the first phase of a large war with Europe, indicating a readiness to strike either at European or American and Canadian homelands or in the Mediterranean.
And this is part of a posturing of forces, which other colleagues of ours, Mark Schneider among them, have pointed out. Some of that's already baked into just their day-to-day status of forces, their intercontinental ballistic missile forces, and even their port-based submarines.
Yeah. By sending their airplanes and submarines and ships to these positions, it's a warning that we're prepared to go nuclear if we have to.
But I'm just saying that they have that inherent capability just from a standing start if they choose to do so. But they're signaling intent, and this is the key piece. So, exactly. Dr. Blank, especially given the rather, well, to put it charitably, antiquated state of our nuclear deterrent and the great disparity between the theater or tactical nuclear weapons, as you've said, that Russians have deployed and those we have. What would you be recommending we be doing at the moment in the face of this Russian threat?
Well, I mean, the nuclear complex needs to be modernized. I know there's an argument about this, but I think it's necessary. And I think the war shows this. And I think Congress has bought the argument. They're prepared. They plussed up the defense budget by very significant amounts. And I think you're going to see more nuclear modernization beyond where we've already started. But what really needs to happen is a much greater conventional deployment in Europe to deter the Russians at the lowest level of aggression so that they cannot start a conventional conflict and get away with it by threatening nuclear, because our nuclear weapons will get through. Even if you made the argument that they're antiquated, I don't really think they are. But even if they are, they would still wreak havoc on Russia, and the Russians need to be told that over and over again. But the necessity of modernizing the entire nuclear suite, as well as keeping our conventional and our allies' conventional capabilities in order, is immense. I mean, the Allies need to keep spending more money on producing effective conventional, or in the case of France and Britain, effective nuclear capabilities to defend
Europe. We have to leave it at that. Dr. Stephen Blank, I appreciate so much your expertise and insights. We very much value these updates from you about the state of the war in Ukraine and the stakes for us here in the United States as to how this comes out, and your clarity in particular about the dangers of the Putin regime and its ambitions. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again with updates, if you would, very soon.
Thank you.
Next up, we are going to speak with Bill Marshall of Judicial Watch about a host of issues, including, interestingly enough, Michelle Obama's possible run for the presidency in 2024. That and more. Straight ahead.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. I'm always delighted to have a chance to visit with anybody from an organization that I've come to admire greatly in Washington, D.C. It's well known, I'm sure, to this audience and I think to an awful lot of Americans, fortunately. It's called Judicial Watch. It does simply incalculably important work, a whole host of issues, holding government officials accountable, trying to make sure that the rest of us understand what they're up to, especially when it's illegal or simply contrary to the public interest. A man who is instrumental to the work of Judicial Watch is its chief investigator. His name is Bill Marshall. He's a good friend. He's been a frequent guest on this program. His work in the past in criminal investigations, both in government and in the private sector, has informed and I think greatly enabled the very impressive activity of both himself and his colleagues at Judicial Watch. And we're always delighted to catch up with them, take stock of some of their doings. Bill, it's good to have you back in Securing America. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be back.
Let me talk to you a little bit about the problem that I know you're tracking very closely with the whole COVID-19 response, and in particular, what we knew about what was happening in Wuhan, China, what we may have done actually to enable some of the gain of function research, as it's called, that was involved in cooking up, it appears, in a biological warfare laboratory in Wuhan, this so-called SARS-CoV-2 virus. Tell us what you've been up to in that regard, Bill.
Right, Frank. Well, thank you very much for having me back on. And you are right. I am very concerned about the COVID issue, both the origins of COVID as well as the so-called vaccines, as you know. Mm-hmm. And this particular story we're talking about, I had requested last year records from Anthony Fauci's agency, the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, which was funding, as we know, the Wuhan laboratory, right, where it is suspected, which is effectively a bioweapons laboratory, right?
Yes.
This is the one
level,
run by the
level four facility, no less.
Yes, sir. Yes. It run by the Bat Lady of Wuhan.
Right.
And they are suspected of having released either intentionally or unintentionally and created this SARS-CoV-2 virus. So I had requested all communications from Anthony Fauci's office about the Wuhan lab and gain of function research, as well as any contracts and agreements with the Wuhan lab. And we've been getting a trove, a series of tranches of documents that have really been stunning. And the ones we obtained a couple of weeks ago through FOIA litigation consisted of 1,600 pages of mostly communications between the various NIAID officials regarding Wuhan. And they're really, really shocking. They indicate, for one thing, yes, as you mentioned, that the FBI had launched an inquiry, if not a full investigation, an inquiry into the gain-of-function research, into particularly this grant that had gone from NIH to Peter Daszak. This is the guy who runs EcoHealth Alliance, which is effectively laundering money.
For China.
Research money, essentially, to avoid, to circumvent prohibitions on gain-of-function research being conducted at the expense of the U.S. taxpayer in the U.S., laundering it overseas so they could conduct it in China, right? Mm-hmm. You have to understand.
This was the same chap who said, there's nothing to see here, folks. There's no problem with this laboratory and other lies, right?
Oh, yeah. And they were, what you can see from these communications, I really encourage your viewers to go to our website. It's the top story right now. It's really one of my more detailed, I will say, and lengthier reports. But it goes into great depth about how concerned NIAID was about gain-of-function research going on in the WIV lab, the wow. Wuhan Institute of Virology lab.
Again, Fauci was lying about this too, professing that there was no relationship with these guys at all or no reason to be concerned about it. I mean, this
absolutely
is stunning, frank. And you know, it speaks to your practice at a very high order of the art form of FOIA, as they're called, Freedom of Information Act, inquiries, requests, litigation. And it's to your credit, Bill, that you've been able to amass this evidence and now help the rest of us make sense of it. Bottom line on it, is there any question in your mind, as we found in a recent study we did of our Team B3 at ccp@war.com, if you're interested in checking out our report entitled The CCP is at War with America, that what was going on inside that laboratory was producing a biological agent, which, however it got out of the laboratory, once it was out, the Chinese Communist Party ensured was disseminated worldwide, including in this country?
Yes, absolutely. No question in my mind that this is gain-of-function research. And you have many powerful viewers of your program, Frank, and I strongly encourage any staffers from Senator Rand Paul's office to look at this article, look at my research, and look at the documents that we got. They were clearly concerned. Anthony Fauci's office was clearly concerned in May of 2016, that they were conducting gain-of-function research at WIV and that they were funding it. And they demanded and they failed to get from Peter Daszak numerous safety compliance reports that were required pursuant to the contractual agreement, you know, that went along with this award from NIH, this money that was funding the Wuhan lab. Yeah. They were required to provide safety reports, which they were failing to provide. And there was a very tense exchange.
I'm shocked.
Between Peter Daszak and Mike Lauer, the deputy director of NIH. Really, really compelling reading, and I encourage all your viewers to go.
Thank you for making it available at judicialwatch.org, I believe is the website, is that right?
Yes.
And the reason, of course, Senator Rand Paul ought to be very engaged on this is he was one of the people to whom Tony Fauci was lying repeatedly, exactly. Under oath, no less. This is, seems to me, a criminal affair. Let's switch gears. Another area you've been bringing your FOIA skill set to bear on is trying to expose the revolutionary activity known as critical race theory, indoctrination in our public school systems, including in those of the District of Columbia, the nation's capital. Give us a quick précis on what you found so far.
Yes, I obtained about 200 pages of records from the DC public school system, many of them from something called the DC Public Schools Equity Strategy and Programming Team. Okay, now this is like your ultimate woke, sub agency within an agency, which is designed to foster this tribalization of not just the student. This program, which they created, did not involve so much the students, but the staff, the teacher, the faculty, and administrative staff of the DC public school system. They created what they called affinity spaces. Now, this is so dystopian. The whole idea was to balkanize or tribalize all the employees of the DC public school system into white affinity spaces, black affinity spaces, Latinx affinity spaces, LGBTQ affinity spaces, so that they could all meet together. And they could all meet separately. But the description of this is just almost hilarious to my mind. But this is one official. This is a guy named Samuel Quadro, from DCPS, writing to one of the principals in the school system. And he says, the goal of these affinity groups is to create a safe space among colleagues to process the impacts of racism and white supremacy within our school community and identify collective actions to take by individuals and as groups. So the fundamental premise of this is that white supremacy dominates the DC public school system, which is hilarious in itself. I mean, this is just, the notion.
I'd be surprised if there are very many white teachers, let alone students now in the public school systems of the District of Columbia. But right. Bill, we have to wrap on this. I want to say, what you're finding in this case in particular sounds as though that there's a very concentrated effort to indoctrinate first and foremost the faculty and the staff of these school systems as a means of getting at their kids downstream. And it's just absolutely horrifying. So again, thank you for the work you're doing at Judicial Watch on that front. And I hope you'll keep us apprised as to what you're finding out more generally and what can be done about it. But before we let you go, I did want to come back to something I teased before the break. There's a new film by Joel Gilbert. We hope to have him on the show to talk a bit about it that you've seen, I understand, about Michelle Obama's plans to become the Democratic nominee in 2024. Give us 30 seconds on what you're hearing and why this is worrying.
Right. Well, Joel and I are friends of many years and we've collaborated on projects, but he approached me with this a couple of years ago and said, I really think, Bill, that the Democrats are going to position Michelle Obama to run for president in 2024. I mean, I was floored when he said that. I mean, I personally don't find many people more detestable than Michelle Obama just for her arrogance, her angry sort of America loathing elitism, this classic leftist kind of positioning she takes. And
I think is kind of in her DNA as far as I can tell. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I kind of dismissed the idea at that time, but having seen his movie, I'm more concerned than ever that he may be onto something. And I think many Republicans or conservatives would say we kind of discounted the possibility because they assume everyone dislikes her as much as
don't underestimate the Obamas is my basic rule of thumb. We're going to come back to you on this and more with Bill Marshall. Our thanks for your work again at Judicial Watch and your reports to us from time to time. We'll talk to you again soon. Next up, Kevin Freeman. We'll do a little tour on economic warfare right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The U.S. and Israeli governments declared for the umpteenth time today that Iran will not be allowed to acquire nuclear weapons. It ain't necessarily so. Israel's interim Prime Minister Yair Lapid is a leftist up for election. He's happy to have a paper pretext not to act in the only way that will, at this point, prevent the mullahs from getting the bomb at any time, namely a full-scale assault on their nuclear weapons program. President Biden is determined to prevent such an attack by Israel as his administration begs the Iranians to sign another bogus agreement forswearing taking that step. The president's promises to use all instruments of American power to prevent it may give unfounded hope to Israelis and others in the mullah's crosshairs, but its only practical effect will be to run out the clock on the preemption option. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. One of the most important fronts in the unrestricted warfare that the Chinese Communist Party is waging against the United States, and indeed one of the most important fronts in, I think, the larger war for the free world, as I call it, is economic warfare. Few of us even know what's going on, let alone its implications. A man we are proud to call a friend and colleague, as well as a go-to resource on economic warfare, is the host of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman at Blaze TV. His name, of course, is Kevin Freeman. He is a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, the author of two best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, the driving force behind a terrific organization called the National Investment Consultants. National Security Investment Consultants Institute, just one of the people who, when there are matters involving the economic vital interests of the United States, I think is an absolute necessary resource for getting the straight poop. So we're going to talk with Kevin for the next two blocks, and I'm very pleased to have him back. Kevin, welcome once again to Securing America.
Thank you, Frank.
We have for some time been very concerned about the extent to which Wall Street has been enabling this unrestricted warfare from the Chinese Communist Party. The underwriting that it is doing by migrating trillions of dollars from American investors to various Chinese companies has been deeply problematic, and I think has been something that you have been really at the forefront of raising concern about. There was an article recently that talked about the Chinese insisting on having the Chinese government, the party, having their personnel on boards and otherwise in controlling positions, not only in Chinese companies, but also in Western companies doing business in China. This is not necessarily a surprise exactly, given the way the Chinese operate, but what are the implications of it as you see it, particularly for those Western companies? And
well, first, it's not a surprise, and we've enabled this. I mean, we have this whole progressive idea that we'll put board members on that meet every category. So you have to have a representative from every racial group and so forth. So we're already down that track, which is a step away from where we should be, which is you put the most qualified people who will do the best in growing the business on the board of the company. But now that we have mandated representation for all sorts of groups, the Chinese want their seats also. And secondly, it's not a surprise because the Chinese do this in their own companies. My friend Gil Amelio, who is the CEO of Apple, was on the board of a Chinese company, and he would go, and there were all these wonderful people there, but there were always two quiet people in the back. And he said, "Who are those?" Well, they're the People's Liberation Army representatives, or they're the Chinese Communist Party representatives. And they're there to make sure that the party discipline is maintained, that the purpose of the corporation is to serve the Communist Party. And that's exactly what they're attempting to do with American companies. We should never allow that. We should never allow board members who are anti-American to sit on American companies. Unfortunately, that ship has sailed in so many ways. Let's not let it sail in this way also.
Yeah. Well, and it's not just Chinese that are anti-American, of course, as you're suggesting. Kevin, let me ask you about a specific company, because it's arguably been at the forefront of this effort to ensure that American investors are underwriting our mortal enemy. And that is BlackRock, whose chairman Larry Fink has been very vociferous in insisting that not only must Americans continue to invest in these Chinese companies, but they should, he argues, triple the amount of money that they're investing. Do you think there's any chance that in particular the wholly owned BlackRock subsidiary, the first of its kind now operating in communist China, has People's Liberation Army or Chinese Communist Party commissars or minders on its board? And might they also be on, or at least influential with, the mothership back in New York?
Well, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, I don't have proof of that, but that is the pattern. The Chinese Communist Party requires representation on any company that does business in China. They're demanding it here. They're demanding it there. So I think it's unlikely that anything else is happening. I would like to point out that, you know, when you throw BlackRock out there, you're actually mentioning the world's largest asset manager. Mm-hmm. And their assets are measured not in trillions of dollars, but in tens of trillions of dollars. You know, they exceed $10 trillion. And Larry Fink, I don't know where he is personally, but there are only two options in my mind. One is he's completely compromised, and he sold out to some globalist concept, construct, or idea that sees China as a power in the world and he wants to be part of it. Or the second one is he's naive. And it's hard to imagine Larry Fink naive, but if he's naive, he's what we say all the time. What we see as a marketplace, our enemies view as a battle space. And, oh, great opportunity in China. Let's go invest there. They don't see it as a great investment opportunity. They see it as a means of controlling the world.
Yeah. And specifically, elite capturing people like Larry Fink who can help them do it, help them financially in the way we've been discussing, but also help them politically here in the United States. And so I get, maybe it's a rhetorical question given what you've just said, but if Larry Fink is counseling that we should triple our investment in Chinese companies, something that I think you would regard both from an economic warfare point of view and a national security point of view more generally, as well as, well, from a fiduciary point of view, you're a chartered financial analyst by training, is all ill-advised at present under these circumstances. Is Larry Fink taking orders from the Chinese Communist Party when he is being pushed out to promote such an idea, do you think?
If he's not, then he is in the position of the world's most important asset manager, the most naive man in America. Those are the only two options that I can find. He's either extraordinarily naive or he's been co-opted, corrupted by the Chinese Communist Party.
Naive seems to me to be an exceedingly generous way to characterize this. Greedy, for sure, but willing to sort of look the other way, I think might be the best alternative to the fact that he has been completely compromised and co-opted. Kevin Freeman, we have to take just a very short break. We'll be right back with more right after this. Welcome back. Kevin Freeman is with us. We're talking economic warfare, both that being waged against us by communist China, that they're being enabled to engage in by Americans like, well, Larry Fink of BlackRock. He's not the only one, but he is a prominent one in this space of investing American dollars, enabling, empowering, emboldening our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party. Kevin, I wanted to switch gears in this block to talk about a very important project that you've been involved in. You're the driving force behind it, that has relevance not only to the topic we just discussed, but to the one I want to turn to next, and that is National Security Investment Consultants Institute. Talk a little bit about the Institute and why it's important if you're concerned about your money being invested in China, point one, and how it might bear on the private equity markets and your ability as an average investor to be able to make money there.
Well, yeah, thanks, Frank. The NSIC Institute, National Security Investment Consultant Institute, is designed to help individuals find financial advisors who will match with their values when they invest. We know there's all this woke investing. We know that there's all this Chinese capture of American companies. So who's helping the financial advisor? That's what we do. We train them. So when clients say, I want an advisor aware of the national security implications of my investments, they turn to an NSIC advisor. We're training them at Liberty University. It's online. We've got a class operating now. We're going to open a new class in September. We hope to make a difference by training 10,000 financial advisors representing $1 trillion of capital. And part of what we're doing there is we're helping them to, you know, look for ideas that will strengthen America and not weaken America. And as we do that and we look at the American stock markets, and there have been very tumultuous lately, we realize that most of the new good ideas are not going public in the stock market, but they're being held as private companies until they've all succeeded and matured and everything else. And so how do individuals invest in those private companies? That's one of
especially
the
early on as their stocks are undervalued, arguably, but earning potentially very considerable equity in the future.
Can I give an example on that?
Yeah, please.
30 years ago when Amazon came public, you know, Amazon we use every day. People, you know, all it's a huge company. When it came public 30 years ago on a split adjusted basis, and when I mean that, I mean the stock is split 2-for-1, 2-for-1, 3-for-1, 20-for-1 recently. The net effect is if you bought a share 30 years ago, you net paid 7.5 cents per share for that stock, which is over 100 right now. So the idea, that's what we want. America, that's the American dream. You get to invest in it. Average people could buy shares of it and succeed. By contrast, Uber, which is a great idea, technology company, makes it easy to get, you know, you're not getting a dirty cab, you're getting an Uber, you know when it's going to arrive, how much you're going to pay for it, the name of the person picking you up, you can call them if you leave something behind, you know how much it's going to cost to get you from here to there, and how long it's going to take, and you know that before you start the trip. It's all a beautiful thing. Well, Uber comes public 3 years ago at $45 a share, and currently is around 20-something, or got as low as 20-something. Point being that we no longer give the average American an opportunity to invest and take advantage of the growth of companies. They're all held in something called the private equity market.
And why is that happening, Kevin? What's the driving force behind the migration of these most promising stocks out of the public and into the private markets?
Well, it's a part of it is the elites wanting to keep the gains for themselves. Part of it is Sarbanes-Oxley, which makes it really difficult for a public company to operate. They've got lots of extra scrutiny on them. So there are a whole host of reasons why it's happening. But the net effect is we're taking away the American dream and we're giving it to the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. We're creating a wealth gap. We're working on the wealth gap. We covered that in the Economic War Room in the show I just filmed. And we're working on it with the NSIC Institute to give average Americans the opportunity to invest in private equity markets. We'll have to have some legal changes to make that possible. But if you have a financial advisor sitting next to you, why shouldn't you get to invest in a promising new good idea?
Kevin, you are a font of good ideas. And one of the values that we associate with your visits with us is sharing them with our audience. And I'm so appreciative for your pointing this particular topic out, as well as the National Security Investment Consultants Institute. And people can find more about that at nsic.org. Is that right?
That's correct.
Kevin, lastly, and very quickly, speaking of your excellent program, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, and I commend it to everyone, not just for the content of the shows themselves, but for the battle plans that Kevin's team puts together, makes available in connection with each of the shows, which are really teaching tools and extraordinary resources. You have a show up now with my colleague, Tommy Waller, our new executive vice president at the Center for Security Policy, talking about the vulnerabilities of our electric grid. You're in Texas. You know a lot about that problem at the moment. Tell us a little bit about the show and what's happening with the Texas grid at the moment that is an object lesson for the rest of us.
Yeah, Tommy is a real expert on national security, you know, having served in the Marines. He is there at the center. He's phenomenal, and he's an expert on the power grid. And just talking to him, I've studied this issue for at least a decade, but he has insights and knowledge that are go beyond, I think, most the experts. You know, he's gotten to a Peter Pry level almost. It's phenomenal. Yes. But one of the issues here in Texas is the excessive heat. And part of it's because of wind power. But the wind doesn't blow as much when it gets this hot, so our grid is under a strain. Could you imagine what would happen if we had that progressive dream of an all-electric car fleet right now? Everybody drove a Tesla. The power grid would be down, maybe down permanently and catastrophically. So you would think that the progressives who want to push an all-electric fleet would be all about strengthening the power grid, expanding production of electricity, but they're not. They're actually opposing it. That raises an important question. Why do they want to send us back to the Stone Ages by demanding an all-electric fleet without protecting our power?
Well, it raises this larger question. Tucker Carlson's been all over it, that the Greens are really destroying not just our country and economy, but that of others around the world as well. We need to be clear-eyed about this, and we need to be taking them to task over it. Kevin Freeman, we have to leave it at that. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to the rest of you for being part of this program. I hope you come back to us again next time. In the meantime, go forth and multiply.